Hi, John Helmer here. If you're a regular listener, you might be wondering why the following episode did not appear at the scheduled time on 29th of May. Well, the reason is that the week before that, on the 22nd, I had a TIA, or transient ischemic attack. In plain language, a small stroke. I'm completely okay now, though on a fair bit of medication and limiting my work hours somewhat. Rest assured that Great Minds on Learning and the Learning Hack podcast will continue to appear regularly in your feed. It does mean we're more than ever dependent on our sponsors and our kind Patreon supporters to keep the wheels turning. We really value that help. If you want to know how you can support these podcasts and keep them going, the simplest way is to join the Hack Pack on our Patreon. For a small monthly pledge of £3 only, you get early access, transcripts and summaries, and our undying gratitude. Go to patreon.com/learninghack and help us keep it coming. There's a link in show notes. Thank you for your support.
Hello, I'm Kate Fitzgerald from the Learning Hack team, welcoming you to a new episode of Great Minds on Learning. In this highly acclaimed series, Professor Donald Clark, internationally famous author, blogger and entrepreneur, joins John Helmer to explore 2,500 years of thought and theorising about learning from the Greeks to the geeks. Our ability to learn from written texts is something we take for granted, but like every other technology that humans use, writing had to be invented. Writing is first recorded in Uruk, modern-day Iraq, at the end of the 4th millennium BCE, but seems to have been independently invented in at least three other places, Egypt, China, and Mesoamerica. It proved a pivotal moment in human history, marking the transition from prehistory to the historical record. In the centuries that followed, writing was to become central to learning, but the earliest uses to which it was put might be very different from what you'd expect.
The god Thoth came to the king of Egypt and showed him the branches of expertise he had invented, number, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, etc. And when it was the turn of writing, the king complained, "It will atrophy people's memories. Trust in writing will make them remember things by relying on marks made by others from outside themselves, not on their own inner resources. And so writing will make the things they have learnt disappear from their minds. Your invention is a potion for jogging the memory, not for remembering. You provide your students with the appearance of intelligence, not real intelligence, because your students will be widely read, though without any contact with the teacher, they will seem to be men of wide knowledge when they will usually actually be ignorant. And this spurious appearance of intelligence will make them difficult company." Welcome to this episode of Great Minds on Learning about scribes. And I hope Donald Clark and I are going to be not too difficult company for you all as we voyage back into the prehistory of learning. Back, back, further than we've ever been before in this podcast, back to the Neolithic. It's about the invention of writing, probably the most important technology ever invented for learning. But as you can see from that passage I read, rather sketchily translated from Plato's Phaedrus, there have been worries about it almost from the start. In fact, that passage, which is kind of a made-up story related by Socrates and the Phaedrus, is quite often quoted nowadays, usually as a way of demonstrating that distrust of new learning technologies has a fine old provenance. But if what I've started with is a bit of a cliché, it serves to introduce some really important elements in our story, which are far from clichéic. In fact, I think quite a lot of you are going to be amazed by some of the stuff you hear here. There's a lot to pack in, so we're going to cover it in two episodes. Donald, this first episode gives you a chance to draw on a whole other area of your knowledge that many of our listeners will not know about. The fact that you not only know everything there is to know about learning theory back to front, but that you're also a bit of an expert in archaeology. So how long have you been into old pots, bones and stones?
There's a nerdy element to this, of course. So if I were to show you around my room, in fact, right behind me now, across this shelf is a whole lot of fossils, and I've got a Neolithic axe that I found on the downs nearby me. I've got a Roman little cheek feel from a helmet I actually found, well, my wife found. So all my life I've been interested. I always, you know, I always have my head down. I'm always looking for things, never my head up. Maybe that's a problem. But actually, my primary interest on the nerdy front is fossil collecting. So, you know, and I'm quite a serious collector there. I've got a house full of them. And last year I bought a plesiosaur, which a plesiosaur arm, as it were, with a vertebrae and some ribs on it and so on, which cost a fair bit of money. But that's my big hobby. And it's history, you know, the big history thing I really love. That's my view of the world, and I like the physicality of opening a rock and finding fossil. But on archaeology, that's also been a sort of lifelong. I've had, you know, I had to retire a bit early, had a lot of time to travel. And so it started, I go to Greece every single year and have since I was 19, I think. And so my first real interest was the Greeks. I didn't really study classics or anything, although Greek philosophy, read Plato, Aristotle, of course. But the Greeks. And then I've been to, you know, so I've been, last year I was in Alexander's, the town he grew up in Pella in northern Greece near Thessaloniki, the school where he was taught by Aristotle. I go to the Peloponnese every year. I've been at so many archaeological sites in Greece. And then I got really interested in the Romans and traveled quite widely across the Roman Empire, way out to Palmyra in Syria. That caused problems because northern Germany, of course, I've been right along Hadrian's Wall and the Antonine Wall and all the Scottish sites, so, and even North Africa. So the whole periphery of the Roman Empire I've been quite interested in. But my big one is Egypt. And that's what I'm deeply interested in because we go there every year and have for a long time since late 1980s. That leads us into this podcast. I've traveled widely in Egypt and I have a deep interest in Egyptian culture.
So before we get in among the stones with their cuneiform inscriptions and hieroglyphs, can you summarize for us, first of all, what we're looking at as our starting point, the invention of writing? Where and when and how did it happen?
Yeah, well, writing's a really interesting technology, and it is a technology. And I wrote about this in detail in my book, Learning Technologies, right at the beginning, because there's some evidence, actually, it may have occurred about 20,000 years ago. A paper was published last year showing what claimed to be proto-writing, little dots on those bison you see in cave art. And so there's some thought that there was a form of what they call proto-writing. It was the sort of, you know, if you look at a bison, when did it give birth to young bison type writing on the walls? But actually writing as we know it, in its fully expressive form, was invented only four places, interestingly. And that was in Mesopotamia, that we'll start with, Sumerian, Babylonian, Assyrian world. That's the first one, about 3,200 BC. And simultaneously, and I'm not too sure what the interplay between these two is, it also happened in Egypt. And of course, this is where agricultural arose on the Tigris and Euphrates, and at the same time, writing emerges. We'll see the link between those two. So you have the Sumerians, Babylonians, and invent writing, the Egyptians, and then the other two are China. China comes much later, about 1,200 BC. It's rather strange origins of writing in China that we'll come to. And then the fourth one is in Mesoamerica, much, much later. Much lesser. And of course, the Spanish conquistadors literally burnt almost every last book or piece of text that was ever written in that part of the world. So only four places. And we're going to take a deep dive into those to see, because if you're looking at learning, formal learning I'm talking about here, obviously we have millions of years where children learnt from their parents and within the social group. But if you're looking at schooling, we have amazing evidence from all of those places, the Sumerians, Babylonians, the Egyptians, and the Chinese, about how schooling emerged. Why did it emerge? How did they actually teach their kids to read and write? What form did it take? And there's a surprising amount of archaeological evidence that tells us how that worked.
So let's dive in and let's start with the Sumerians. Sumer is the earliest civilization we know of, located in southern Mesopotamia, now Iraq, emerging during the Chalcolithic and early Bronze Ages between the 6th and 5th millennium BC. This is one of the cradles of civilization, along with Egypt, the Indus Valley, the Yellow River Valley, Carol's Supe in what is now Peru, and Mesoamerica, as you said. So in Sumer, living along the valleys of the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, Sumerian farmers grew an abundance of grain and other crops, a surplus which enabled them to form urban settlements. The world's earliest known texts come from the Sumerian cities of Uruk and Jemdet Nazar and date between 3350 to 2500 BC, following a period of proto-writing, as you said. Donald, I think it's going to astonish people, as you said, to hear how early in this period we start to see schools.
That's correct. Yeah, so the evidence for schools, we have a one of the things about writing in the early Sumer civilization is that it was cuneiform and on clay tablets. So the scribal stylus was a reed that you could just, you know, snap from the side of the either Tigris or Euphrates. And of course, you had clay, which was plentiful. And you would literally poke it in to give the different symbols and cuneiform, beautiful forms of writing. And the best place to see it is the British Museum, who is the greatest. They have the greatest collection of this in the world. But if we go back to the evidence for schools, actually, one thing that's worth pointing out, I think, in both Egypt and Sumer is the status of writing, because it very quickly became almost a theological issue. So in Sumer, we have Nabu. Nabu is the Sumerian god of writing. They have a god for writing, which is amazing. And in the Mesopotamian pantheon of gods, you know, this is he's the son of Marduk, who's the big god, as it were. So here's a really important point. Writing is something given to you by God, okay? This is the god not only of writing, but of wisdom, interestingly. So it has a very high status. And scribes, of course, in both Sumer and Egypt, lived and were taught within temples that were sometimes dedicated to that god. So writing and literacy has a very different status from what it has in our world. You know, it was much more important than that. A tiny number of people did it. They were all boys from quite wealthy families. You know, it was an elitist thing. But your question was about the evidence for schools. Now, the lovely thing about cuneiform in clay is when the cities get burnt down, the clay gets baked. So the archaeology is nicely baked for us and permanent. And then you have evidence for tablets in a lot of sites, Shrupuk, Urjik, Urari, there are all sorts of places where you find these rooms or areas with these piles of tablets, okay? And some of them are clearly school exercises because they have copied proverbs. That was the big one, letters, administrative documents. And they use all of these things to practice their writing. And we have evidence of these small scribal classes, as I say, mainly the sons of wealthy people or noble families. Now, the tablet house is, in a sense, a school, what they call the eduba. And the eduba is a school. We have evidence from literally tens of thousands of tablets that the curriculum was quite rigorous. The students themselves, corporal punishment was very, very common. They spent many years learning how to read and write. And the teachers had quite a sort of, you know, they had some status within the society. So it was an organized educational system. We see that emerging. Remember, there is prehistory here that's quite clear on the Neolithic axe that I have behind me somewhere. In fact, I can show you it right now. So this little teardrop axe, which I found, a beautiful little axe on the hills not far from my house. Actually, try making one of those, as I have. It takes about 500 hours, and it was quite clearly that you needed language and the teaching and learning process in that. But on writing, something else happens here. So in all these cuneiform tablets, you suddenly see dictionaries emerge. You have translations between languages. You have lexical lists, multiplication tables and mathematics very quickly, because writing allowed you to account for things. So these are the first agricultural societies. They had a surplus of product, which they would sell and trade with other people. You needed to account for that, okay? So not only did they have an accounting for the physical goods in their societies, there was an accounting of your soul. This is where it gets really interesting. You know, you get that almost like a PwC version of accounting for your sins. And that happens in Sumer as well, but more importantly, as we'll come to, also in Egypt. So you have this evidence of these schools where there's a lot of discipline. They're literally whipping and striking people. There's another really beautiful thing that you see, which is, I think it's in the British Museum, is there's a beautiful little on the bottom of a piece of clay, a picture of somebody just used their thumbs to give a very expressive view of a stern teacher. And this teacher is looking very sort of, you know, like harsh, as it were. So we get little insights from the archaeology about what schooling was like, but they took it very, very seriously indeed. And so that was the general thing. We can go on, I can give you examples then of very specific things within that culture. Shall we do that?
It's very interesting that I a few years back happened to be in Oxford and dodged into the Ashmolean Museum, and there saw some Sumerian tablets and cuneiform and early writings, and kind of read the captions about it. And it was a surprise to me, being a kind of literature person, to learn that the earliest uses of writing were actually kind of lists of, you know, the wedding gifts that had been given to a king, or for kind of accounting purposes and so on. You know, ages before people started to put stories in there. And so it made me think that, you know, in technological terms, we might say they invented the spreadsheet before, you know, Microsoft Word, that you know, and then that came later, which is interesting. But there is a specific text, isn't there, which is called Shuropak, Instructions, or the Father Gives Advice to His Son on Life. You talk about
The Shuropak, That's right. That, you know, when we look at learning theory, for example, then this is the first text, you know, that actually gives you, it's called the Instructions of Shuropak. So this father's giving his advice to his son about how to live their life and, you know, what's ahead of them. And I think what's interesting about that is the guidance, you know, it's quite a nice text because it talks about the importance of education and wisdom, more importantly, and living a good moral life. And you're right, most of this was lists, detailed administrative records, almost dull and boring lists of things, or transactions. They even had envelopes for contracts with a clay around them that they could send to other people and you would send it back and so on. But there are a number of, you know, quite important things, higher level texts that... that show how these scribes were trained. And that is a key text because it goes into a lot of detail there. Now, an important source for all this was there are two big libraries here. There's a library of Nippur and the library at Nineveh. Mm-hmm. Now, the Nippur library, it's in modern-day Sumerian city in modern-day Iraq. This is the late 3rd millennium BC, so this is really early, you know. And it was only discovered, of course, when you get serious archaeology in the 19th and 20th century, where they discover thousands of these tablets and have to unravel them. And the British were really exemplary at this. A much bigger and later library was the Library of Nineveh. That's about 620-630 BC, much later, okay? But has many, many more tablets. There were about 30 to 40,000 tablets found in this one place. 30 to 40,000. That's the Akkadian language. And there you see the, going back to the storytelling you mentioned, there you see the Epic of Gilgamesh in its fully formed story. The Gilgamesh story actually goes back, it's much, much earlier than that. And it exists in a fragmentary form. Often you have to piece it together from little bits and bobs that you find. But we certainly find in the Library of Nineveh a fully formed one, a version of this. It was referring to a religious text, really, that accounting for our souls, as it were. Yeah. But we also have evidence, fantastic thing they found in this library, were little simple balls of clay. So you roll a little ball of clay, okay, you flatten it between the palms of your hand, and then the teacher writes a proverb on one side, and you have to write the proverb on the other. This is very clever. Because it's not like copying from a copybook or a blackboard. You actually have to remember the proverb when you turn it over to write it.
Yes.
So it's a double hit on memory and skills. You know, so the fledgling scribe doesn't have to just write it. They also have to remember and recall it from memory to write it.
Yeah, it reminds me of doing kind of comprehension exercises or exercises in school where, okay, now read the text, now cover it up and then write, answer these questions about it.
That's right.
Yeah, very, very similar. Yeah, I'd heard about the Epic of Gilgamesh because, you know, it's a Penguin classic. And so that comes into the literary world. And another kind of literary point, which has come up more recently, is Enheduanna, a Sumerian princess who lived around 2300 BC and composed what is now thought by many to be the earliest poetry by a known author. Her father was Sargon of Akkad, which you mentioned, who said created the world's first empire stretching from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean And as part of his imperial mission, he installed his daughter as the high priestess of the temple of the moon god Nana in the city of Ur. Now, a lot's been made of Enheduanna. I should say I can remember how to pronounce her name from Cyndi Lauper, from Girls Just Gotta Have Fun. Just the Wana, Enheduanna. That gives you the right kind of intonation, I feel. But that is not entirely irrelevant, because Enheduanna is a bit of has become a bit of a feminist icon.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that the first named daughter is a woman and so on, although that's slightly disputed. And in fact, it's quite possible that she was, you know, apart from either being a mouthpiece for her father, the king, it's possible that she kind of was a tradition rather than a single individual, in the way that Homer stands at the end of a tradition. So we're in that kind of handover from the oral to the written.
That's right.
So we do start to get into literature in this, but as you say, it's a bit later. And there are interesting parallels between what you say about the Epic of Gilgamesh and, of course, the Homer story. There were a lot of different versions and bits and pieces of Homer that I've heard were sort of assembled in the Great Library at Alexandria. And the kind of editing that made it into a final text may well have happened there by that book that we both read by Adam Nicholson. I think he mentions that the book about Homer. But anyway.
You've really done your homework. Yeah, I love that introduction with Cyndi Lauper.
Enheduanna. I'm sorry,
And you're absolutely right. So she's really early in the, you know, record to be the first poet. But the danger here is just reading too much into it. As you rightly said, she might have been more of a semi-legendary, so a symbolic figure. But and whether she existed or not, some people question. They also question, remember, a lot of this writing isn't necessarily attributed to individuals, but a lot of it's propaganda. So there's some debate about even the authorship of the texts attributed to Enheduanna. But certainly it's fascinating because it is real poetry. And it has real relevance to that culture, and is very, very early. The Epic of Gilgamesh is slightly different, of course, because, again, there's no author of the Epic of Gilgamesh, but boy, is it there, and it's fully formed in a very early form. And they were into mythological writing. A really fascinating thing about all this, though, and there's a real expert, a guy called Finkel at the British Museum. Actually, a huge amount of this writing, and this is true in Egypt as well, was about divination. You find that they are absolutely obsessed by trying to use text or writing to predict the future in battles and so on, led by the king. Masses and masses of this. In fact, in the British Museum, they have a clay tablet of a sheep's liver with holes in it, because you get flukes, which are wormholes in a real liver, those fluke holes, and it's in a grid with cuneiform predictions next to each fluke hole. And it's actually in the shape, a clay cuneiform sheep's liver, which they used for divination. It was used to teach scribes how to use divination when they slaughtered a sheep. You also will see this when we come to China, you get the same thing. And especially in Egypt, where they become obsessed, almost, you know, the Book of the Dead, all these things are full of writing, which is almost like cheat codes to get into the afterlife. So we almost immediately get with writing this notion of being able to predict the future, a bit like a recommendation engine in AI. Which
I wonder how long it would be before AI came in.
But it's an absolutely fascinating. People have often focused on the lists and so on, but if you really look at the quantity of writing in the Sumerian, Egyptian and Chinese examples, you see this mass of divination.
While Sumer is not so widely known about in mainstream non-academic culture, ancient Egypt is a perennial source of fascination for multitudes of people who may know little otherwise about the ancient world. I had an auntie and uncle who were both absolutely obsessed with ancient Egypt, more along the lines that my auntie, in a former life, she'd been an Egyptian priestess, and so they went to Egypt a lot. Ancient Egypt's very much part of popular culture in a way that Sumer isn't. It was a civilization concentrated along the lower reaches of the Nile, which followed prehistoric Egypt and coalesced around 3100 BC with the political unification of Upper and Lower Egypt under Menes. Its history unfolded as a series of stable kingdoms interspersed by periods of relative instability, known as intermediate periods. The various kingdoms fall into one of three categories: the Old Kingdom of the Early Bronze Age, the Middle Kingdom of the Middle Bronze Age, or the New Kingdom of the Late Bronze Age. Ancient Egypt reached the pinnacle of its power during the New Kingdom, and then there's a decline after that. Donald, what's the story of writing and learning within this history?
Well, Egypt's a place I go to a lot, and I actually managed to get, you know, I can just barely do the cartouches and introduction to prayers, read a little bit, just get a glimpse of how complex hieroglyphics is after many years of sort of being there. The interesting thing about Egyptian writing, about the same time as the Sumerians, about 3,200, 250 BC, and like cuneiform, its meaning was completely lost. So they were still writing hieroglyphics in the 4th century AD. The last one is in the south, in a place called Philae, on a temple there. But we lose that. But of course, then, luckily, we have Thomas Young and Jean-Francis Champollion, who, interestingly, John Young did most of his work in Worthing. I don't know if you knew that, just along the way from us here in Brighton.
On the
south coast, John, yeah. So they cracked the code in 1822 or so. And everybody was expecting this marvelous literature from Egypt, full of these philosophical secrets and lots of really interesting stories. And it was a massive disappointment, because it was mostly like cuneiform tablets, accounting, these massive lists, and a huge amount of divination, spells, the Book of the Dead and so on, to do with preparing you for the afterlife. It turns out that most Egyptian text is obsessed with the preparation for an afterlife, or keeping the temples running, or giving gifts to the gods. It was almost like all writing in the Middle Ages being about the Bible, you know. It was that bad. But the what I love about Egypt, just like Sumer, they have a god of writing. Thoth. Some people pronounce it Thoth. I've heard that, but I'm not too sure. We don't actually know how the ancient Egyptians pronounce things, because all we have are the consonants. We don't know what the vowels were like. But Thoth is this ibis-headed figure with a long beak, and you see this figure everywhere in Egypt. Remember, in Egypt, the wonderful thing is writing is everywhere. It's on the walls of the temples. If you go to the tombs, I was there in December, Valley of the Queens, the Valley of the Kings, every one of those tombs, as you enter and descend for 100, 200 meters into the limestone, the walls are laden. Sometimes a roof has writing on it with hieroglyphics. Writing is a holy thing for the Egyptians. It gives the word of God permanence. So Thoth is the inventor of writing and hieroglyphs. It's not hieroglyphics, by the way, it's hieroglyphs. Keep correcting myself on that one. Thoth, the gift of writing, is critical for the writing, therefore, of spells and prayers. And you see this in the pyramid texts, you see it in the coffin texts, and more importantly, in the Book of the Dead. These are just everywhere, in the coffins, on the walls, the preparation to help you get to the other side, okay? So his words are considered to give you the sense of, you know, the powerful magical words to give you protection and guidance to get you over the threshold. Now, the Book of the Dead is the big one, and that's where, maybe getting a wee bit too detailed here, but it's worth showing how detailed they were on this issue. Thoth is standing there when you die, and they take your heart and put it on one side of the scale and weigh it against a feather. This is another god, the feather of Mat. Mat is the woman with the feather sticking out the top of her head, a bit like Pocahontas, as it were. Yeah. Mat is the goddess of truth and order and balance. So did you live a good life? And if you fail, you don't get to the other side. You get devoured by these evil demon-type gods. If you do, and everybody does, because all these spells, writing gives you all, a bit like the computer game cheat codes, it gives you the cheat code to get through. So it's a very, writing takes a very odd turn in Egypt in many ways, you know? And Thoth is one of the most important gods in the Egyptian pantheon. You see him everywhere. Now, to jump down to the scribal class for a minute, because that's important. Again, just like Sumeria, Babylonia, and Assyrian cultures, you have these scribal or scriptoriums, and you find them almost always in temples. And I was at one quite recently, in fact, in the Ramesseum in Luxor. And you can still find the writing tools. You know, we have a huge amount of archaeology about this. But hieroglyphic expression is everywhere for about 3,000 years. It reaches a really amazing point with Seti the First, that's the New Kingdom, where aesthetically you have these beautiful sort of examples of writing which are embossed on the wall. You know, they're like little bits of sculpture that sit upon the wall, not just written upon flatly. Ramesses the Second, he was a real power-hungry guy. He inscribed things deeply into the wall because he wanted that sense of permanence in eternity. But I'm giving you a sense of how important writing was to the kings, the cultures, the priesthood. It was essential to the theology of the country because it was a holy thing. And it gave you permanence and eternity. We don't see writing in that way at all. But the Egyptians really did think that writing's gift was eternity. It had a very important thing. And we have this clerisy, this class of scribes, a bit like the sort of monks in our Western European culture, you know, who were using Latin, of course. But there is this sense of them imposing power on the rest because it was a small number of people. And then there was a lot of other stuff about, you know, the laws, setting the laws to control people. Tax collection was a huge thing, and the general control. But still you have the sense of sacred permanence, the spells getting you into the afterlife. So that's the background to this. I think it's really important to understand what the status of writing was in ancient Egypt. It was not like writing as we perceive it here and now. Yeah. It had a special, I wouldn't use the word holy, it's more of a Christian word, but a sacred status.
Hieratic, yeah. It can seem to us that the Egyptians were very death-obsessed, but, I mean, if you kind of, the comparison you make there with monks, and you look at Christianity, when that became the dominant ideology in the early modern period, and William Burroughs referred to it as the Christian death cult, really, the job of writing and education there was to equip you for your death, to make sure that you went to heaven rather than to hell, to kind of put it crudely. And in our own age, we're more likely to think about Heidegger, who said that death is the horizon of your possibilities. So existentialism, in a way, is another kind of death cult. I don't know. So perhaps it isn't as kind of difficult to understand in terms of its function with writing and learning as we possibly think.
One thing I've learned about going to Egypt a lot is how different it is from the European concept of death. So when you're in Egypt, it really is idyllic. You're sitting having breakfast by the banks of the Nile. There's bird life everywhere. And of course, in ancient Egypt, you had the inundation, which gave you fresh soil every year. It was like a gift from God. Life was good. And if you go to the smaller personal tombs in Deir al-Medina, the workers' village, you see that these beautiful frescoes of them, you know, with their dogs and cats, life was good. It never rains, perpetual sunshine. You have plenty of water, plenty of food, plenty of animals to eat, so on. And you get the sense that, you know, Mat is a really important god there, the god of balance. They were a very quiet, gentle people who really did enjoy life itself. So death was all about the continuation of that wonderful life. It wasn't like the Christian notion of being judged or else you go to a hell. I think it was a very different concept. And writing played a big role in this. The writing was all about the bountiful gifts that you give to God and these big piles of meat and beer and bread as offerings. They had these processions every year that went on for weeks around the temples to keep the whole thing going. They thought that the world would collapse unless you did this, by the way. You know, there was that cyclical sense of having to feed the bear, as it were. But actually, when you come down to going back to, so that sense of mat, harmony, balance, order, justice was a big Egyptian thing. And you get a feel when you go there still of that.
We actually have some kind of named great minds here. We've got a trio of Egyptians. We can talk about, we could call them writers of educational texts, maybe, or writers of, I think, wisdom literature is a phrase. But for our purposes, they're great minds. Donald, tell us a bit about these three scribes. And let's start with Tahotep. I'm forgiven for my stumblings because you just say we don't know how these names were pronounced. I'm going to give it a go, and I think it's Tahotep.
Yeah, Tahotep is, so he's quite a senior guy. He's a vizier, you know, so he's a top dog in the civil service under this way early. This is the fifth dynasty. And there's not almost 30 dynasties. This is the fifth dynasty. Around about, it's about 2300 BC or so. But so you get this guy, and you get a real text here around these principles of map. But he links writing with morality, okay? But it's a nice little text because it gives you an idea of what it is to teach. What is it people are teaching through writing here when you're teaching young people? Okay, so it's not like a textbook, this, but it is a guidebook for young people on how to behave well in life. And there are a couple of things that emerge from this. There are two really, one really nice thing that I really love is he really stresses the importance of listening. It's almost like a course on listening skills. Time and time again, you get these little sentences about being silent and listening to others before you speak, respecting silence. I really love that, you know. You know, it's the ignorant man is the man who does not listen, you know. And I think that's nice. The second thing is a respect for the people who teach. You know, as a good student, we'll listen to the teacher and listen attentively. And I think that's the first example you have of reflection on good teaching methods. Tahotep is a very interesting fragmentary text, but the bottom line is you only speak when you've got something worth saying, which is certainly a nice line to follow, as it were. But it shows you the educational method where learning it happens, as it were, by the attentive listening by people who know better than them. And I think that's we have the first evidence for this. Speaking only carefully and eloquently and being very calm in your response. This is not, you know, they would have hated social media. teaching as a teaching tradition where the status of the teacher is such that you have to pay attention. It was also, we must remember also, and that's explicit in this text, that obedience is valued. And actually, a corporal punishment was very, very common. Every classroom had someone, there's a good reference to them using a hippopotamus whip, which I think is the tail of a hippo. They actually whipped kids and beat them if they didn't learn properly. And let's not imagine we didn't do that until recently. I was thrashed with a leather strap at school. So let's not imagine that we were, this is something that's, you know, that is primitive and despicable. We were doing that until very recently in our own country. But it's the first text that gives insights into teaching and learning and some of the virtues of pedagogy in a way.
Right. And then how about Duaketi?
Yeah. I thought you were going to give me a Dua Lipa reference there.
I was going to, actually. It's strange that you should kind of telepath that. I held myself back. I thought, you know, I'm just kind of cheapening everything with these pop culture references. But, okay, Dua Lipa.
Yeah, right. Okay. Let's write like an Egyptian,
yes.
Well, the instruction of... The instruction of Duaketi is a really key text also in the pedagogy thing because this is written by a father to their son type thing. So that's a really interesting text in that side. It's sometimes called the satire of the trades because what it's saying is it's a really good thing to be a scribe. In other words, listen to me, son, get a job over there because hard labor is no fun. Okay, so there's this emphasizing the sheer value of education and being a scribe. And a sort of diminution of the worthiness of manual work. And it's written in dialogue, a bit like you give the example of Plato's Phaedrus earlier, but he mentions the god Thoth, interestingly. And he puts this diatribe against writing, he puts in the mouth of Socrates, interestingly, because Plato was actually all in favor of reason and long-form writing. But writing in this text, the Duaketi text, is seen as a big differentiator, a real skill, a real profession, you know. It gives you all that status. It allows you to advance in the world, gives you big advantages. But it's also full of ethical understanding, little quips about that as well. So we have a couple of things pedagogically there as the importance of learning. the importance of learning as a form of social mobility and advancement within that culture. And if you go to Egypt and go to any museum, you'll see this you'll see these statues of the scribes squatting down, the scroll in front of them. They have a very important status within society, which is below that of the gods, of course, because we have the god Thoth. But in the clerisy or the priesthood, they are controlling life itself, not just the administration of goods, things that come into the temple, you have all that stuff, but keeping the whole cosmology going. Writing is the engine that keeps everything alive.
That's amazing. And how would they feel to come back now and find that their job in life was to turn out stuff for almost no money and to be scraped by AIs for Sam Altman's enrichment? But don't get me started. And to keep our pop culture references, Annie, are you okay? Annie, are you okay? The third of these Egyptian scribes is, I think, pronounced Annie, A-N-Y.
Yeah.
Or any old iron. Yeah. I don't know.
Yes, this is an interesting one because the Annie text or the Kempt, I like this one because it's got some satire in it, which I quite like, and it critiques the educational system. So we have people who are praising wisdom and the teaching and being a scribe and so on. And of course, you hardly ever have, we're not quite sure of who this Annie person was really, but the work itself is quite ironic, you know? We don't quite know when it was written. And they've actually had to reassemble it from lots of ostraca in the Dera of Medina. It's a village near Luxor where all the people who built the tombs in the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens actually lived. An amazing place. I've been there many times. And they built their own tombs, which are beautiful little, tiny little shed-type sized rooms that are beautifully coloured inside. Really worth visiting. But this text describes a student's efforts to become a scribe, okay? But it also reflects on both teaching and learning. The first thing is that it's quite clear that the learner has to go through hours and hours of repetitive memorization. What's new? Sit your GCSEs. On top of that, we have real insights into the very strict discipline, absolute corporal punishment here, you know. But there are also the upsides here. Annie is also mentioning that, again, this whole notion of social mobility. Being a scribe is something that's worthy. Persevere in writing. That's what he's saying. You cannot be poor in it, is the line. So, you know, you will have a good life, you'll make good money, you will have high status, but you also get beaten to an inch of your life if you do it. That's what you have to sacrifice to get there. Mm. But I really quite liked that text because it had a little bit of humour and satire. It was all pieced together from these ostraca. An ostraca, by the way, is a little bit of limestone with a little bit of writing on it. So you get, it's almost like reconstructing a full poem from individual lines, but they've managed to do that. There's another really interesting thing here, I think, before we leave the Egyptians and go on to the Chinese thing, because another really interesting place in Egypt is Alexandria. And of course, we tend to think of Egyptology as dealing with, as you say, the old, middle, and new kingdoms. But along at the tail end with Cleopatra come the Ptolemies. And this is Alexander the Great, of course, is Greek culture. And Ptolemy the First does an amazing thing, I think. He builds the Library of Alexandria. He collects 700,000 scrolls, 8.4 billion words. And he does that by buying, stealing, he does anything. In any language, he writes to all the leaders in the region and says, give me your texts, and he keeps them. Now, what I love about this is about 2,300 years ago, Ptolemy the First, that was one of Alexander the Great's generals whom he gave Egypt to on his death. Now, so what you have at that moment is the sum total of human knowledge in as many languages as you can imagine from many, many different places. Now, there's a really interesting, I'm not forcing this in, but I think there's a really interesting, they also have papyrus, of course. They also have the medium, the medium on which things could be cheaply written. And in fact, they used that to good effect because Ptolemy embargoed papyrus, it was 190 BC, to stop the growth in other libraries like Pergamum. So he wanted one place. It was almost like building this large language model. And he succeeded in doing that. Yeah. Not only did he build what was the biggest, you know, language model in the world, he did all the metadata and data preparation. So all the stuff was tagged. You had a standard data standard. And then there were categories, a bit like the Dewey Decimal System for that medicine, history, legislation, philosophy, comic, epic poets, and all that sort of stuff. And that allowed, and it was, the doors were open. Anyone could walk in and use this stuff and research it. Now, what was amazing in the back of this is suddenly you get this explosion of creativity in science, in literature, in engineering. You have Euclid, his 14 volume of The Elements. That, interestingly, had the first ever written algorithm in it. The algorithm is about calculating the greatest common denominators. Give me a number, give me the greatest common denominators for that number. And his theorems were used right up into the 20th century in that textbook. You know, that was a foundational text for geometry and mathematics. He wrote another book called The Phenomena, which is about geometry of spheres.
Right.
Conic section. Then you've got Canonus, you've got Ptolemy's first book in geography, Eratosthenes, who calculates the size of the Earth. He realized that the Earth was round, almost giving a sort of pre-Copernican view of this, interestingly, and calculates the circumference by having two rods with shadows. He was accurate to within 50 miles. Amazing achievement. You have medicine, you have literature, you have Archimedes. They're inventing things like the self-trimming oil lamps, syringes, coin-operated vending machine for holy water, believe it or not, fire engine, even the steam engine. Amazing things happen. And I really like this because I think this is a bit like the LLM AI world we're in now. In fact, it was almost comparable. I did a rough calculation. The 700,000 scrolls, about 8.4 billion words. The GBT data set is about 300 billion words. So it was a big data set, mm-hmm. which fed and fueled this advancement and progress in humanity. An interesting tail off there. I'm sorry if I'm getting obsessed by this. I just found the parallel so interesting. You also have deep fakes at the time as well. So almost immediately.
Deep fakes.
Almost immediately in the Library of Alexandria, you had loads of scams and forgeries and people selling books they shouldn't have and so on, pretending to be authors they weren't.
Oh, the scams.
An interesting and sad end to it, maybe this will happen to AI as well, is the library didn't burn down. Recent scholarship shows there was no burning of the library.
Oh.
It was actually the Christians who just, they started bringing out laws when Christianity hit Egypt at that time, very early, the Copts, first, second century AD type thing. They started to ban the books and the shelves just became empty until you have a horrific event with Hypatia, who is literally torn limb from limb by a Christian mob. That is the end of it all. And then we enter into the whole era, which we've discussed before, of St. Augustine, scholasticism, the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
But what a wonderful place to be at that time. The Library of Alexandria, which was there for hundreds of years, fueling advances in a way that we had never seen before. Absolutely astonishing thing.
And one of the seven wonders of the ancient world.
Indeed.
Well, no. That's astonishing to me what you say about it not having burned down, but being
kind of
shut down by the Christians. Really interesting. I mean, my questions about that. I just want to come back on one thing we were talking about, wisdom writing, which I discovered in my scant bit of research before we did this, that there were two types of it, as you say. There was the sort of the very positive stuff, but there was the more satirical, critical stuff, making fun of stuff, lampooning it.
Yes.
Being rather anti and nihilistic and all the rest of it. And it's interesting that is there in the modern world. In fact, almost everything was there in the ancient world that we now have in the modern world, when you really think of it. And nothing's really quite so new.
That's right, In fact, there's some really good examples. I give the example of the little portrait. The child has clearly used his thumb to create a little nose of this horrible teacher on the pot. But you also, in Egypt, on the Ostraga, again, go back to Deir el-Medina, there's this huge pit there that you can visit, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of Ostraga with bits of writing on them. And amongst that writing, there's a lot of pornography, which is interesting. Yeah, yeah. But also quite satirical stuff of like the queen, the pharaoh of the day, or the king in odd sexual poses and so on. Yeah. And then lots of jokes and lots of satirical stuff. So writing, in a sense, is promiscuous. It betrays real life as well, because people take notes, have a laugh, write jokes.
And so do critical thinking, of course, yes.
Yeah, let's not imagine that these people were just, you know, slaves to some weird pantheon of gods, and every moment of their lives were like that. They were like us. They had children, they had a laugh, they got drunk, they had sex, all the things that we are familiar with in writing, even today in other media, they played around with. And so the great thing about writing is it can be a playful thing, can't it?
And there's one other question I've got before we move on, which we have to, which was something you said there about anybody could walk into the Library of Alexandria and use it, and it led to all those innovations you talked about. But levels of literacy, because we tend to, you know, not everyone was literate. When you had the kind of scribal caste, as it were, in Egypt, although they didn't have a caste system, literacy was kind of limited and controlled by religion. To what extent was there anything like mass literacy in the ancient world?
Well, it just didn't exist. I mean, you have a little bit. I mean, it's a matter of degree, of course, but you're talking about a tiny number of people, sometimes down to the sort of 1% level, but as you're moving into Greece and Rome, you get a large one, but still incredibly restricted. Most people are still illiterate, which is why you get a lot, you know, in Egypt, statutory. The interesting thing about hieroglyphics is a lot of it's pictorial. So in a sense, you get a sense of this without being able to read it. And of course, they had loads of statues. Statues really matter in the ancient world, and paintings. We've just uncovered an amazing number of things in Pompeii showing the Trojan War from the Iliad, for example, because most people had to be fed visual imagery. Now, remember, this is true in the Middle Ages as well. Go into any church. I'm just back from Spain. Look at the Baroque paintings in those churches, because people couldn't read. It's not until the Reformation that you get mass schooling and mass literacy. And so, you know, it was very much a vehicle for control. But it also it created a scribal class who could also reflect in a fun way as well. But fundamentally, it was owned by the rulers, the various forms of aristocrats, aristocracies and oligarchies, and it was used as a means of control, either theologically or through laws and restrictions on the vast mass of people who couldn't write.
So moving on, kind of undue atmosphere of levity has crept into these proceedings, Donald, and you've kind of egged me on. So I'm finding it hard not to introduce our next country without doing it in the voice of Donald Trump, where he says, China!
Very good.
The history of China spans several millennia across a wide geographical area. Chinese civilization first emerged in the Yellow River Valley, which, along with the Yangtze Basin, constitutes the geographic core of the Chinese cultural sphere. The traditional lens for viewing Chinese history is the dynastic cycle. Imperial dynasties rise and fall and are ascribed certain achievements. And we will have heard all these names like the Zhu and the Qing and the Ming and whatever. Throughout pervades the narrative that Chinese civilization can be traced as an unbroken thread many thousands of years into the past, making it one of the cradles of civilization. The Neolithic period saw increasingly complex polities begin to emerge along the Yellow and Yangtze rivers. I should say I'm reading this from Wikipedia. I just want to make sure that there is some kind of authority to what I'm saying here, because really I don't know what I'm talking about. I know nothing about China in the ancient world. The Erlitou culture in the central plains of China is sometimes identified with the Xia dynasty, 3rd millennium BC, of traditional Chinese historiography. The earliest surviving written Chinese dates to roughly 1250 BC, consisting of divinations inscribed on oracle bones, Chinese bronze inscriptions, ritual texts dedicated to ancestors, form another large corpus of early Chinese writing. Donald, how did writing and learning in China begin then, and how did it develop from those beginnings?
That's right. It's much later than the Sumerian or Egyptian writing, about 1200 BC, and has this really odd origins as oracle bone scripts or divination. And this is in the Shang dynasty. I'll put my own Scottish pop reference in there, Shang-a-lang by the Bay City Rollers, if you want to.
Yeah. So much to answer for.
Oh, Shang-a-lang, and he rang with the gang singing Ota Diddly Doo-Day or whatever it was. Okay. The characters, this divination is really fascinating. So they would burn an animal bone, usually a scapula, or sometimes a turtle shell, and then they would inscribe characters. They would look at the patterns, the burnt patterns on the bone, and then write, expand those into characters. And those inscriptions were, as you rightly said, used for predicting the future. Also, and then it emerged and developed and evolved into record keeping. And so you'd ask questions of the ancestors. Ancestry was a big thing in Chinese theology. So you'd be, through the use of these burnt bones, you would be asking questions of people who had already died, or deities, sometimes gods, about all these future events, battles, the weather, other people you were fighting, where they were, and so on. And that was the ancestral roots of all those characters you see in Chinese writing. And that's exactly where they came from, and you can trace them all back to that. Now, what happens there, as it did in Sumer and Egypt, is scribes emerge. And so you have these very skilled individual specialists who master all this sort of divination and rituals and administration and record keeping, and they start to play this incredibly important civil service role in China. I've used that term civil service here because this becomes incredibly important in China, which has this, it's the most important place in the planet. There's heaven on earth and Beijing. That is the center of the universe, okay? But this is all prior to the 6th century BC, when almost all teaching was done within families and so on. There were no schools, in a sense, that there were in Egypt and in Sumer. But, as you rightly said, something interestingly happens here. You have this thing called the 100 Schools of Thought. And the 100 Schools of Thought emerge much later. And this is like 8th century BC, the 6th century BC, and in the Warring States period, which is amazing. My friend Ken's a real expert in this. It was brutal. Every little municipality was fighting and massacring everybody else. It was absolutely brutal. Strangely enough, just like ancient Greece and the Peloponnesian Wars, it was brutal. You get the emergence of this intellectual explosion where loads of philosophers and scholars start writing their own ideas and competing for academic dominance. So you get Taoism, the I Ching, and all that, the Way, Confucianism, of course, which we've discussed in another episode. You have Legalism, Mohism. You have all these schools of thought on the back of writing. Without writing, you don't have these schools of thought because you don't have that sense of permanence and full argumented expression in a book like the I Ching. So teachers then have an important role. But in China, it really is about obedience to the state and imparting moral values. This, if you read Confucius, the Analects or whatever, it's all about respect for ritual, ancestry, obedience, and the obeying a set of moral values. These moral values are not like Christian values. They're much looser, I think, and much, much more interesting. But it's about maintaining the social order. I think that's the main thing that comes through writing from this early Chinese period, is the degree to which it's very much trying to maintain social order. Yeah. And ritualism, incredibly important, hence its origin in these oracle bones. And what you're doing, just like the Egyptians, you're sustaining this nice balance between heaven, earth, and society, that triad. Everything has to be in balance, and writing was all about this. Confucianism in particular, of course, where the role of the teacher becomes important, the respect for the teacher. And that's still true in China today. I've actually did some teaching online in China, and they hardly ever ask questions at the end. There isn't that sense of critical thinking. You know, there is this, tell me what is right and I will learn it. A very different culture in terms of learning, which comes from those early days. So writing has a really big impact on China, but in a very different way from Sumer and Egypt. Mm. And you still have these massive countrywide exams where literally millions of people sit and memorize lots of things to get a position in the civil service because you're made, your family's made if that happens. So a very different culture. The purpose of education is very different, much more social. Your role in life is not to be an individual. You know, writing, in a sense, there are lots of theories that claim that writing gives you a huge boost on individualization. In the West, that certainly happened, but not necessarily in China.
It's interesting, looking across the ancient world, though, that, you know, when we look at the things that define what we call civilization, that troublesome word, one of the first things to arrive that's really important and comes along with writing is bureaucracy.
Yes, indeed.
We see it in China, but also we see it in Sumeria, we see it in Egypt.
Yeah.
We see it in Greece and Rome to a degree as well. Writing helps the state to kind of, through this bureaucracy, to exercise control over larger and larger areas of the world.
And there's been a huge amount of reflection on this, of course. There's a philosopher, a sociologist, really, and philosopher called Pierre Bourdieu, who's French and writes in a very French way. But he explores this in a huge amount of detail.
Who we will cover in episode two of this.
Yeah, that's right. And just to touch upon that, he invents the phrase cultural capital, you know, and thinks that actually writing creates cultural capital, but it's not all good. Because cultural capital comes to define who you are and where you are in society and brings in hierarchies, you know, the objectified state, institutionalization, bodies use writing and so on and so forth. But there are lots of very interesting writers who, of course, have tackled this issue that we'll cover in another podcast.
Yeah.
So, the interesting one, I think, is Greece, though, you know, because we're in the West obsessed by the classics, you're right, there's a bit of a distortion or bias there. We have Havelock, who, in his preface to Plato, he says, we don't have Western civilization without writing coming from Mesopotamia. And I've actually stood in the town where it came from, a place called Ur in Syria, and you see this little tablet that has some of the Greek letters on it. That comes into Greece.
Yeah.
And, of course, eventually you have Plato, Aristotle, the pre-Socratics, this explosion of abstract and critical thinking and Western philosophy, really sophisticated, permanent thoughts, long-term reason and argumentation from Plato onwards. So that shift from oral to written communication is a huge deal. And that's what today's episode has been about. But we tend to forget that that happened well before the Greeks. You know, it happened in these ancient civilizations.
So to sum this up a bit, let's start summing up before we move into looking towards the second episode of the story. So the story we've heard so far is of learning intimately connected with the history of writing from its very earliest times, within a nexus of religion, power, and societal status. And it is so interesting how religion is there, bound very closely to writing, bound very closely to power in these societies. Regular listeners might reflect on how these same themes have resonated throughout our investigations to date, through the rise of Christianity, Islam, and other great faiths, through the Enlightenment, through Romanticism, the German idealists, the advent of universal education, and even on now into our own day. So, Donald, before we look forward, how would you sum up this scribal era that we've described today?
I think that's right. I mean, you give a very good summary of that yourself there, John. I think there is this sense in which it's not what we think it was. The scribal era gives us some clues as to how culture was eventually going to develop. But it was rote learning, memorization, obedience, the pedagogy of punishment we were discussing. It was a very different thing from what we have glimpses of that in our schooling system, I suspect. But this was power for the few over the many, to summarize it. You know, in all three of the cultures we've examined there, that's important. But we also, as you rightly teased out, we have some glimpses of the power of writing in terms of critical thinking and philosophy and science that comes through Greece and in other places. We get a sense of it being used for humor and the playful carnivalesque view of language. Back then used to call, I love that word, carnivalesque language. I think we get glimpses of that as well. We get the emergence of We get the emergence, unfortunately, of Gilgamesh is great, but we also get the great books that turn out to absolutely control our cultures, whether it's the Torah, the Bible, the Quran, or in Buddhism, other Vedic texts. And they absolutely stranglehold culture and societies. And, you know, Nietzsche called it the 2,000-year aberration, you know, of Christian hold, where people were kept illiterate. It wasn't until the Reformation comes along where we suddenly say, hold on a minute, we have printing here. We can print things in our own languages. We don't have to have this special clerical class who speak Greek and Latin. We can free ourselves from those bonds. But have we freed ourselves from those bonds? We still teach Latin in a ridiculous act of, you know, avatism. We still, in snobbishness, we still teach Latin in schools because it's a vestige. Who learns Latin? Those middle-class parents who like to think that their kids are going to pull one over on everybody else by having that on their CV. We still have those vestiges of that in our system, which saddens me in many ways. Nevertheless, language, what a wonderful thing it is, you know, once we managed to get universal schooling and we could all start to write, and that's what really excites me about this, and as you know, this is my shtick, John,
yep.
I think we've had a renaissance in literature. People say, oh, your books are dying and so on. Actually, kids write every day, every 5 minutes, they're talking to each other in dialogue, different forms of language. Mm. We have the emergence of new forms of communal communication, you know? We have social media, we have, of course, artificial intelligence, which is breaking the mold on language. Suddenly we have something that can actually write, a machine that can write, that draws upon a large language model, which is us, it's the accumulated culture of human beings in many languages from all over the world. We have this like Alexandrian example, and it can produce text. We just need to ask it to write something for us. That is so fascinating to me. It blows my mind that that has happened in my lifetime. Yeah. And therefore, I think we're entering a renaissance, another view of writing entirely. Just like the invention of writing, we have the invention of machines that can write. I think this AI event is as important as the invention of writing, which was attributed to gods back then. But actually, we find out that it's us who invented writing, and that we can use it for all sorts of wonderful things going off into the future.
And that's what we're heading towards now, as we look forward to our second episode. It's clear from all this that the story of writing and learning is far from over, as we handed over to the Greeks, because we've uncovered something important about the relationship of writing and learning, something that Socrates alludes to in the dialogue I quoted right at the front of this podcast episode. Writing is not just a carrier frequency for learning. Actually, the two are in a kind of tension, a very productive tension. But tension nonetheless. And it's this tension that is explored by a group of thinkers we want to cover in part two of this episode, theorists from the 20th and 21st century who thought about literacy and orality and how the technology of today might in an odd way be bringing us back full circle. Yeah. I've just got a hint at that now and leave that there. We'll explore it further in the next episode. But Donald, could you give us a brief taster of what's come?
Yes, there are many really wonderful writers in this area. The big name there is Walter Ong, but right through to more recent people like Clay Shirky, McLuhan, of course, is well known for this. But we have some maybe unknown people, like the great book, Marshall McLuhan I was referring to there. You have Bourdieu, the French philosopher, who talks about cultural capital and the way in writing embeddies of fossilizes that. You have Goody and Watt, who write this really brilliant books called The Consequence of Literacy. That was, we have literacy, we have writing. What on earth happened thereafter? A really wonderful book that is. But the big name is Walter Ong, who was a Jesuit priest, interestingly, who taught in the universities. I can't remember where it was, in America somewhere. Yeah. But he talks about the shift from orality to literacy, which we've been discussing today. But of course, you used the perfect phrase there, John. We're coming back full circle, back to orality. I have an Alexa in my room I can speak to. We have dialogue now through chatbots. We're coming full circle, but not only that, we're getting an explosion of multimodal forms of communication. We're getting away from being choked by in a sea of text. Writing may not be, you know, the written text might not be as important as we thought it was. Being a human being, you know, you send your kid off to school at 5, they pop out of university, they do a master's degree or whatever, and all they've done is read and write. That's it's all text-based. But actually, that's not what life is like. And that's because that's the only medium we had, really, for teaching and learning. Actually, perhaps we're going back to a much wider multimodal world where speech matters, where agency, interaction, dialogue matters. That's what chatbots are. That's what social media has given us. Perhaps video and these other media are important, where we can ask it to create things. I think that's why this new window in the world is so important. And we'll be discussing some of the people who laid the foundations for theorizing about that, albeit in the form of books.
Okay. So I hope we haven't had just the spurious appearance of intelligence, which might have made us difficult company, as the god Thoth said at the beginning of this. And thank you very much for sticking with us. And we hope very much that you will come along for episode 2, subscribe, and it will pop up in your device. And in fact, for the rest of the season. But thank you very much for this one. Thank you, Donald.
Thank you.
Great Minds on Learning comes from the Learning Hack team and is produced by John Helmer. The podcast is based on a series of blog posts written by Donald Clark, and we thank Donald for his kind collaboration in this project. If you'd like text summaries and transcripts for these podcasts, as well as ads-free listening, early access to episodes and more, why not join the Learning Hack Pack? For less than the price of a coffee, you can get all these benefits and help to sustain us into the future. Go to patreon.com/learninghack for a 7-day free trial. That's patreon.com/learninghack.